just out this door, and Philip will give some more instructions and a prayer before lunch here in just a minute. We're going to start the Q&A here now. Shane's going to take over, and you're on the spot.
Very good. I do have a couple of questions written down on cards, but I thought we'd open it up first if anyone had a question they just wanted to ask Ken, and who is brave enough to take mic in hand. Well, Randy, I don't know if that's appropriate. I think I should go to the card first, but I'll submit to your ecclesiastical authority, though.
You mentioned something in the lecture today that you and I have spoken about before, and one is this sort of thought experiment that you had about assuming if everyone were already saved,
right,
and converted everyone, what would discipleship look like then? And you've talked a little bit about how there are many different categories that most of us never even think about, whether it's economics, whether or not it's art, whether or not it's the way we live our lives, whether or not it's the way we raise chickens, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Can you just speak to maybe an item or two on that list about specifically what that might look like, or how we would even think about it so that we can understand discipleship?
Well, I'll try to be brief. Laughing nervously. I often answer this question. People say, I talk about churches as countercultural communities, for instance, and they'll often say, well, what would that look like? And it's the same kind of question, because basically I'm suggesting that we should be deliberate about the choices we make in the way we organize institutions, the way we make artifacts, the way we order our social life, the way we engage creation. We should be deliberate in accordance with the nature of creation. So we should ask ourselves, if sin weren't disordering things, what would be the best way to live? And then we try to figure out, well, how can we begin to approximate that? How can we come closer to that? And when I describe churches that I think are countercultural, among the features that I like to talk about, and I think this has relevance particularly to the way the church has made decisions based on its interest in evangelism and allowed its interest in evangelism to eclipse everything else, and that is the rise in the late 20th century of what we now call youth culture. That is the idea of segregating generations into separate cultural communities, which really is a very, very new phenomenon. There was no such thing as youth culture. The phrase teenager wasn't even used until late 1940s. And youth culture itself is a contradiction in terms. If culture is a way of passing on convictions from one generation to the next, then what's a youth culture? It's a way of passing commitments from advertisers to young people and passing their money or their parents' money onto the advertisers, largely. The idea that it would be a good thing particularly for adolescents and teenagers to be guided in making life decisions without the intervention of adults. No one has ever thought that would be a good way to order society. I mean, if you sat down and say, what would be a good way of ordering society, that wouldn't be on a list of ideal social construction. Now, we get this phenomenon for a variety of social and economic reasons. We get the phenomenon of youth culture, and suddenly, because people find it irresistible to submit to it, and because of the fact that at the time when it emerges as a possibility, the adults who are running things have lost a lot of confidence in the propriety of authority, and they've certainly lost a lot of confidence that there's a natural order in the nature of things that should be honored. And so youth culture becomes a kind of status quo in the culture at large. So the thing that interests me is, how does the church respond? Well, Within days, the church has embraced this for evangelistic reasons. Youth for Christ, Young Life. Christian Youth Crusade. You know, all kinds of ministries suddenly spring up to basically say, okay, if we're going to have youth culture and we need evangelism, then let's stratify generations and let's do evangelism by embracing youth culture. I keep talking to students who are thinking of, I've talked to a number of students who are pursuing degrees in history. And I keep asking somebody to do a dissertation on this phenomenon, why did the church embrace this so badly? Now, we can see in hindsight that it's a remarkably destructive way of ordering society. So, I mean, this is a very I think it's a good example because I think it shows that it's a case where decisions were very deliberately made for the sake of evangelism and not for the sake of a healthy ecosystem. So I would argue that churches should be places that are remarkable for their intergenerational activity. That the people who are in churches, if you grow up in a church, you should be used to spending time with old people. Just because it's natural. The natural way of ordering life is not to separate generations. That separation of generations serves commercial interests, and it may serve some other social interests, but I'm not sure what they would be. But it certainly doesn't serve the best interests of becoming a mature adult. And that's why I think it's increasingly hard for each successive generation to actually aspire to be a mature adult. Now we have, you know, as they say, 30 is the new 20. We now have a group called emerging adults, which are... They're, you know, from the time you're like 19 to the time you're 29 and your parents are wondering if you're ever going to leave home, you're an emerging adult now. And all of that, I think that's a form of disorder, but it's a form of disorder that has not been resisted. Two other real quick things. In what would that look like? That I usually show up on my list. And the first is our attitude toward and our practices concerning language. I argue that language is one of the best gifts. Language and music are two of the greatest gifts God has given us. And so to delight in the possibilities and the capacities of language and to develop those capacities and possibilities and to honor them in our public institutions and to train up our young people to be as poetic and expressive and as eloquent as they possibly can, because this is a great and delightful thing. I mean, we still honor Shakespeare for some reason. but what has happened particularly since the mid-1960s, and I actually interviewed a linguist who's written a book about this called Doing Our Own Thing, subtitled The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care. My favorite subtitle. and it's on the decline of eloquence in public speaking. He compares speeches made after 9/11 with speeches made after Pearl Harbor and speeches made during the Civil War. And he finds this decline, particularly after... He says after 1965, and he's a younger man than me. He's not some old fogey like I am. And he was a professor of linguistics at Berkeley. He argues that with the cultural changes of the 1960s, and with the suspicion toward authority that became a dominant theme of the culture in the wake of the 60s. There was also a suspicion toward formality, because formality is basically recognizing the authority. It's rather than doing your own thing, it's doing things which have been determined by somebody other than you and honoring them. So if you follow rules of decorum, if you remove your hat when you come into a building or if you don't sit down until the hostess has sat down, or if you use formal patterns of speech to describe things, particularly in very, very significant settings, like in the wake of a national disaster, there's a certain sense in which you are deferring. You're setting aside your natural, instinctual kind of behavior. You're deferring to a model of authority of some kind, and we can't have that. So doing our own thing means that we can't be required to strive to do the best and most magnificent things that language can do. So we actually, in the interest of preserving self-expression, we actually become less capable of expressiveness. Now, I would say if language, and you can build a significant theology of language from God said, let there be light, to the Word became flesh. I mean, the way, and not to mention the fact that we believe that God reveals himself in language, that language is the mechanism of discipleship. And we have a very high view of language. And as a result, Christian poets historically have written some of the best poetry that all cultures admire. People learn English so that they can read. Now, of course, people learn Russian to read, and some Russian poets do. But I do think that that high view of language has been present. Now, again, I've seen this in the church in my own time. The move toward informality in speech, which has been part of the broader cultural. Not that every conversation is marked by formality, but particularly significant speech should have the capacity for formality. And I think to have a sense of how poetry functions I like to say in churches, our kids should be more conversant with poetry than the average American kid is, because this is part of our legacy. This is part of what we believe. So rather than saying the church has to dumb down its language because the rest of the world is, and we don't want to be too much unlike the world for evangelistic purposes, I want to say, well, as long as we know there aren't any believers in here, can we speak well? You know. And I'll be much shorter on the third one, and that is I always talk about our use of food, our culture of food, to regard food as merely fuel is a kind of desecration. I think God created us as creatures who need to eat for very big reasons, and I think the fact that that one of our sacraments is a meal, and that we anticipate an eschatological meal, it ought to make us take meals and eating much, much more seriously. And there ought to be a sense, the Orthodox theologian Alexander Schmemann says that meals have always been a kind of secular sacrament. That is, they've reflected something magnificent in the nature of things, which is why almost every culture has some traditions of reverence or ritual tied to many, many meals. Now, Americans in particular we treat meals in the most utilitarian possible way, and we treat our whole relationship with food in the most utilitarian possible way. I don't think that fits a Christian understanding of reality. And so I'd say, well, rather than being just like our neighbors with regard to food, how would we best honor the realities of creation and the structure of creation and the meaningfulness in creation in the way we deal with food? So those are three quick things that I would mention.
Ken, jumping off from subpart B there of language, youth, and disorder, I think this next question applies. What is your perspective on rap music, particularly rap with Christian words that are thoroughly precise?
Thoroughly precise?
Thus says the questioner.
Okay. Because I worked at NPR, I've had a lot of opportunities to talk with non-believers about aesthetic choices that Christians make. And they're often very perplexed. And I would, if I were a betting man, I would bet money that most of my non-Christian friends in music or in the arts if you ask them about Christian rap, they would furrow their brow and ask, why in the world would you want to do that, to be honest? Now, because rap is a form which developed to express certain kinds of emotions and convictions, and not other emotions and convictions. It has a very limited emotional palette. Similarly, I was talking to Randy last night with heavy metal music. Now, there were heavy metal Christian bands back in the 80s. And notably, most of the texts they used were from the really angry Old Testament prophets. It was kick-butt Christianity. They never said, blessed are the meek. They never wrote songs about gentleness. And it's kind of hard to imagine a lot about... It's a lot easier, and I think these guys knew it. It's a lot easier to write songs about judgment than about grace with when you have a musical vocabulary that has an implicit violence about it. Consider the body language of most rappers. Swagger is a word that comes to mind. Humility is not a word that comes to mind. Okay? And I think most serious rappers would agree. Now, sadly, I think what happens is Christians who sometimes are a little bit colorblind with regard, and I don't mean with race, but we're tone deaf with regard to the kind of non-propositional meaning that's being conveyed in a particular aesthetic form. And so we see, oh, there's a form that's popular. Let's insert Christian lyrics into it. Because the form is meaningless. But the people who created the form and the people who sustain the form, they know better than we do very often that the form is not meaningless, that it actually has a connotations about it. And I just think that if you pay attention to this, there's a jazz music critic named Stanley Crouch, who used to write for the Village Voice. And he's a good friend of Wynton Marsalis's. He writes all the liner notes for all of Wynton Marsalis's. And he's a very, he wrote a collection of essays called Notes from a Hanging Judge. He's a very serious critic. And he left the Village Voice. I think he got fired because he got into a fist fight with one of his colleagues. He's an African American, I should say. And Crouch, who's just kind of he will never romanticize anything, okay? And he got into a fist fight with one of his colleagues because he says, yeah, my friend thought that rap was sublime and I thought it was slime. And he lamented, he's written this in print, he compared rap musicians with Duke Ellington and Count Basie and some other African-American musicians from the 30s and 40s and 50s. And he says, we no longer have a vocabulary of elegance. And he lamented the fact, as a black American, that the only vocabulary, the only aesthetic register available to young blacks was a register of resentment and violence, and not elegance and purity and beauty and delight and all of those other things that were present in Count Basie's work and in Duke Ellington's work, especially Ellington's. So, I'd say, what is the meaning, the connotation of the music that's there, and then if there's a way that we can use that to express something that we want to express, then let's go ahead and use it. But then the other thing is I'd say, particularly with regard to liturgical use, I mean, I'm a big, huge fan of classical music, but like 98% of classical music doesn't belong in a worship service because it's just not fitting. I was in a service once, and we had a wonderful sermon about humility, and after the benediction, the organist played this totally incorrect organ, a movement from an organ symphony by Vidor. And it was brilliant, but it just was the wrong thing to do, having heard a sermon about humility. So I'd say I gave a lecture earlier this year on how might music mean, on meaning in music. And one of the things I did was there's an English comedy program called I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. It was on for decades on the BBC. And one of the favorite features on this program was a feature called One Song to the Tune of Another, where they would take a popular song and they would sing, the panelists would sing the words from one popular song to another tune. So one of them was, and I played several of these, and they're hysterical because everybody there knows that the text, the content, the verbal content, is in total dissonance with the musical content. So one of them was a song from the 80s, Girlfriend in a Coma, which is kind of dark, which was sung to the tune of Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Girlfriend in a coma, I can't remember how it all the words go. And people are hysterical. They're just laughing all over the place. One of them was, I don't know if you know, that there's an old English pub song that was sung very enthusiastically during the Second World War. It came out in the early 40s, the Lambeth Walk. It was, actually, it might have come out earlier. It might have come out in the 30s. But it's very kind of jaunty and da 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 da. So one of the contestants was asked to sing William Blake's Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright. And it rhythmically fit, but again, it's hilarious. And I would encourage you to do this. Go online and search one song to the tune of another. And you might need, and I'm laughing at just thinking of some of the others. They're just brilliant. It was on the show, I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. Now, I've heard of people try to set a mighty fortress to polkas. Doesn't quite work. Or to salsa, you know, a kind of bossa nova thing. And you know what? Just the imagery of a fortress, it's got to have a kind of... Now, granted, Luther's original version did have a little bit more syncopation to it, but not that kind of syncopation. I have not actually heard this song, but apparently there's a very popular praise chorus that takes the text that's often sung during Lent, "From the depths of woe I cry to thee." And you probably, I don't know, maybe have sung it here. It's very, again, a music from the depths of woe I cry. I've heard it sung, and it's very, again, a very jaunty tune. Has nothing to do with the depths of woe. Just does not compute at all. Now, I think what happens is people, again, they're ignoring the musical meaning. They're saying, here's something people like. Here's an idea we want them to embrace. Let's marry the two. Which is a little bit like, I don't know, Hookers for Chastity, or Professional Wrestlers for Humility. I mean, you could try that, but at some point there's a cognitive dissonance that sets in if people are really paying attention. And you almost have to not pay attention. You have to decide, I'm not going to pay attention to what's actually being, to the meaning of the form. So I went longer than I'm supposed to on that.